You're listening to Humanitarian Radio with your hosts, Tony St. Tone and Janie Beauclair.
Good afternoon and welcome to Humanitarian Radio's 100th show.
100th show.
I am Janie Beauclair.
And I'm Tony St. Tone.
We welcome our first-time listeners to the show. We are here today shouting out some good news for your soul with some great inspirational guests each week and positive music by St. Tone. You can also find out what's happening all around the world and on our events calendar and what's going on with us, what causes we support, and what we've been up to by checking in at humanitarianradio.com and Facebook. So it is our 100th show.
Yeah, and I have to say that we have been able to meet such incredible guests along the way. It has been such an incredible journey for the past 2 years, meeting so many people that are doing great things out there that we probably would have never heard of unless we started this radio station.
Yeah, something that has been really fun for me is now that we've got 100 shows in the can, we've put all 100 of them up on a website, humanitarianradio.com, and we actually organized them for you guys to be able to find them easier. Whether the guests were organizations and fundraising related, if it was entertainers, actors, comedians, specialty shows that were like people that were on Oprah at Christmas time for their, you know, Oprah's favorite gifts.
Right.
And then we have a section for doctors and healers and spiritual teachers and pet psychics and things of that nature. So now you can go on to any of the 100 past shows and this show, of course, and listen to it again. You can email it. You can go, you know, if you're having a tough day and you're looking for a little boost, you can listen to any of these shows any time of day.
Yep. They're available 24/7. And now that it's well organized, it's that much easier to get to.
A lot of fun. And we also have a section for causes on our site, which we just added. And, you know, we've been fundraising for a gentleman named Mike Precise for a bit of time. We have raised $1,750 for him. He is legally blind and 30 years old, just turned. Happy birthday, Mike. And he is, we're trying to save his eyesight. So we need $10,000 total. We thought we needed $25,000 until just 2 days ago when we got to go to the doctor for the first time and sit with him and did 4 hours of exams on Mike. Wow, that was tough. I sat through that and filmed that with him. But we learned that if he acts quickly, he can get away with doing less surgeries.
Right.
And instead of having 3 surgeries on each eye, he only needs 1 on each eye if we do this like literally within the next 4 weeks. And so we have to raise the difference between $1,750 and $10,000 in order to get Mike to 20/20 vision within 30 minutes of his surgery.
Yeah, which is incredible because the fact that there are surgeries out there that can be done to correct this type of vision and that it's only $10,000. I mean, it's really not that much money when you consider that this guy has not been able to see correctly for the past 4 years and he's getting worse every day. From what I understand, the way his vision works, he sees 4 to 6 of everything because his eye is turning into like a football shape.
Yeah, exactly. The shape of it is football, and so he can't put contacts on. And what the surgery does is changes the shape of his eye so that he can wear contacts to correct the vision. It's that simple.
Yeah.
There's one guy that does it. We found this guy as a result of the Winter Olympics. Dr. Boxer Wackler in Beverly Hills, California, he treated the bobsled captain.
Correct.
And the bobsled captain's last name is Holcomb, and I know this because now this treatment is called the Holcomb treatment.
Yeah.
So this gentleman's
so it's been named after him.
Yep, named after him, saved his sight. We happened to be watching it one night, and we knew this was what Mike had, so we decided to jump on the bandwagon and raise some money and help this guy get his vision back. And let me tell you something. If you're feeling very giving, you can give another $10,000 on top of that, and we can take care of his twin brother as well, who also has the same disease, the same issue.
Yeah, so if you want to help out in any way, go to the Cause tab on our website, and you'll see a picture of Mike, and you'll see a donate button, and it's that simple. It goes through PayPal, it's direct, and you can help someone see again.
Indeed. So next we have coming up our very special guest for this 100th show, and we are absolutely delighted to be bringing Ken Cragen on board today. Ken is the behind-the-scenes guy as well as creator in a lot of phenomenal international shows, Live Aid, We Are the World, to name a few. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with Mr. Ken Cragen.
I'm living here in a state of abundance. I'm counting blessings that I never saw before. Because I'm the ruler of this kingdom I call me.
Positive affirmations wrapped in pop rock songs.
Give me that best case scenario.
It's motivational musician Saint Tone.
Stereo.
Check out his latest live show, The Rise Up Experience, at www.sainttone.com.
Mama said we can always hug it out.
Pick up his latest CD, Outside the Box, available on iTunes. For music with a positive message, check out sainttone.com.
So I am Janie Beauclair. We're here with Tony Saint Tone, and we are just honored today to have the fabulous Ken Cragen visiting us.
That's my honor.
How are you, my dear?
Terrific. Absolutely great.
It is
enjoying every minute
such
of life.
A pleasure. And I'm really happy you're enjoying every minute of life, because that's one of our mottos is, if you're going to go all the way.
Yeah.
No sense having a little fun. Have all the fun in the world you can have.
I love that, because people say to me, so, you know, what do you do? I say, I do anything that I have fun doing.
Right.
I'm not limited. It can be in any area.
Right.
Any area.
Yeah.
As long as I'm enjoying it. You know, I try to teach that. I teach at UCLA, mm-hmm. you know, and, I tell my students right away in the beginning, your career is not your life. Your career is one of the tools you use for the best life possible. So let's find a career for you that's fun, fulfilling, that you're passionate about, that you can really enjoy. And then we'll design that. We'll find a career that services your life. And then I'll show you how to be successful in that career. And for me, that's what I've done with my own life.
What a beautiful thought. You think about how many people are in careers that they dread going to work every day. They hate life while they're there, or wherever the there is, whatever it is they're doing. And the thought pattern of design a career around the life you want to live.
Exactly. Design a career that services your life. I do worry, though, because I teach at UCLA in the music school, but a lot of my students are from all over the campus.
Okay.
And some of them are pre-med, and they're going to be doctors. And I get these notes at the end of the quarter when I finish teaching these kids saying, you know, I came in here to be pre-med, but I've decided, no, I'm going to follow my music. And I'm waiting for parents with pitchforks to show them my house. We're going to tar and feather you.
Isn't it great that they actually realize it there and then, as opposed to getting into med school and you know, becoming a doctor and going, I don't really like taking care of sick people. I'd rather be playing music.
You know, it's just not the music career. It's whatever career services the life.
Exactly.
And I get students from all over the campus, but I'm so thrilled that I used to teach in extension. I taught for 8 years in extension at UCLA. I've been teaching 3 years now in the music school in undergraduate, and I am so glad to get them as undergraduates, because that's when they need to examine the direction
they're
going. Otherwise they just get in this career and follow it, and they could be miserable their whole life, or at least not as, maybe if not miserable, at least not as enjoying their life as much as they should.
And a lot of people are choosing their careers based on what their family thinks they should do. My parents want me to be a doctor. My parents want me to be a lawyer. My parents want me to be. What do you want to be?
Well, UCLA is probably almost 50% Asian, and there is a huge thing, and I'm not, nothing, I mean, it just happens to be a fact that Asian parents really push their kids into being those kind of set careers.
Lawyers, doctors.
Yeah, I mean, I had a girl come up in class, and she was a world-class pianist. She's won awards all over the world, but she was in physics of some kind, right? And I have kids write on the board the things that they're most fulfilling and they're passionate and excited.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing in there about the course she was taking. Nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing about the physics. It was all about the music. Yeah. You know, now I wonder what she's going to end up doing. But
well, and unfortunately, music's been a really tough career for people to have. And there's so few that make it in that world. That I'm sure it's tough for parents to go, yes, I want you to be in the music world.
Well, the big thing I try to tell them is keep even if you're not doing that as your full-time profession, don't abandon it. If you enjoy it,
keep it,
make
as your
it
hobby
a big part
of
your life in some way. And in this particular girl's case, when she came to my class, we started looking as a class at, were there some ways that she could be doing things that contributed to music through in the science area? Could she be inventing or studying or doing things that would enhance musical performance?
Well, listening to the vibrations of music and how that
enhances
and changes your body or whatever, and talk about the physics of that. So, but I think it's a very important that people follow their passion. And if that passion is there, it might not fulfill you monetarily, but it fills your soul. You know, so like you said, as long as you keep it in there somewhere to keep you going.
I have these incredible guests: Quincy Jones, Lionel Richie, David Foster. They come every week.
These
students
must be falling out of their chair when people
amazing.
Walk into
it's
your
amazing,
classroom.
You know, who comes to my class?
We're going to have to stop by.
Yeah, you should. And every one of them, the same word comes up, and you just used it: passion.
Passion. Yeah.
What's your passion? Follow your passion.
Yeah.
Lionel, though, had a great line. I love Lionel. He said, as soon as they start calling you crazy, that's when you know you're going to be tremendously successful doing something special.
That's awesome.
I love that. Yeah. I love that.
That's the kind of thing, because you know why? Because now you're off the grid and you're not doing it normal anymore.
That's right.
So everyone goes, why are you doing that?
Yeah.
You shouldn't be doing that. I left Connecticut to move to Florida to be a full-time musician, and everyone thought I was crazy. They're like, are you crazy? You don't even have shows there yet. I says, that's all I'm going to do. And sure enough, I did it. But no one was ready to leave their nest, and they were going, that doesn't make sense. I go, I know, because it's not your typical way of doing things.
But you had to have that passion in
1,000%.
Order, because I'm sure you ran into all kinds of obstacles.
And the obstacles, I overcame every single one. But exactly, I had to have that passion. Let me tell you also that everyone that told me all the reasons why I shouldn't, I blocked them out.
That's
just kept going, nope, I'm going to be a full-time musician. They're like, yeah, but you don't. I'm like, nope. And I would just constantly cut them off even before they started, because I couldn't allow them to plant that seed in me. Because then that's that seed of doubt, and that can quickly take over. And I couldn't allow their fear to intrude on my passion, because they weren't comfortable with it. They're like, I could never do that. I go, I know, that's you. I'm me.
You know, I had one of the guests in my class was Snoop Dogg's producer, Terrence Martin.
Yeah.
And Terrence Martin, he said, and we were talking about failure and learning from failure. He said, no, failure is not even a word in my vocabulary. It's not part of my life in any way. He said, the guys I grew up with are either in jail or dead.
Yeah.
He said, I'm a success every morning just when I get up.
Just for being alive.
Yeah.
He said, there's no failure in my life.
Yeah.
It was amazing. It was an amazing thing. Yeah.
It's extremely powerful.
So you've been really successful at a bunch of different really cool events that you've either created or been a significant part of. Some of the things you've done are the We Are the World, Hands Across America. You did parts of Live Aid. You've done some really phenomenal things that have resulted in great benefit to humanity. How did you get involved in that realm? What inspired you there?
When I look back, a couple of things. First, my parents were two of the most giving people ever, and my mother was so much driven to help other people that I remember actually getting her. She started crying one time when I sort of criticized her for the fact that she had to spend some time on herself, not all her time on everybody else. And she actually, it bothered her, because her whole life was devoted to helping others.
Yeah.
And so I think that's original inspiration.
Sure.
I think second to that, after many years of being very successful in the business side of it, I started managing Harry Chapin.
Okay.
And a lot of people won't know or remember Harry Chapin, except maybe from Cats in the Cradle or some of his other big hits.
Mm-hmm.
But Harry Chapin was the most prominent, most active humanitarian in the entertainment business in the late 1970s, until he was unfortunately killed in 1981 in a car accident.
Right.
And he devoted most of his year to doing free shows, to doing all kinds of stuff in which he raised money for charity. He politicked. He got President Carter to create a committee on poverty in America. He did all kinds of stuff like that. He was really the champion of that. And Harry Sill was a tremendous inspiration. He showed me what was going on, things that I didn't realize. I mean, the number of people that...
He was definitely involved in what was currently happening at that time.
Yeah, you had an experience,
yes,
right? You
got to see it. He was very inspirational for me as well, because at the time when I got to stay with him and hang out with him, we were doing food drives.
We were
collecting cans of food, and everybody who came to the concert in Sarasota, Florida, had to bring a can of food, and we ended up with thousands of pounds of food that we gave to the local shelter.
You know what? This probably was at the time I was managing him. Because,
that's what I'm thinking.
Because I created that very same thing for Kenny Rogers.
Oh, did you?
And
okay.
We did it
really
on an even bigger scale, because Kenny was Harry was drawing a few thousand, and Kenny was drawing 10 to 20,000.
Right.
And we would get a local car dealer to put a truck outside, or a bunch of trucks, pickup trucks, so they could show off their cars, but then you would put the food in the beds of
the
car, fill up the pickups, and we'd drive them to the chandelier and stuff. But yeah, it was Harry. Harry was tremendously an inspiration for me. And it was so interesting, too, because when I did We Are the World 3-4 years after Harry had passed away, I always credited Harry as being the inspiration. But I had a very, very interesting experience. I was in New York. I had just come from Life magazine, where they were doing a big spread and a cover on the recording of We Are the World. And I was in a car being driven to whatever the next appointment was, and literally felt physically like Harry had crawled up inside of me and was now orchestrating everything. I'm not that religious. I'm not that, you know, out there in terms of my beliefs. I'm very scientific. I have a, you know, background in astronomy and stuff like that. I mean, I'm like into science, and yet all of a sudden, there was Harry inside me, and you know, and that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
I actually felt physically he went, and there he was.
Sure.
And
he took over.
Yeah.
And he always took over.
How do you do?
Well, you know, I mean, we did pretty doggone well. You know,
that's perfect.
That project, you know, but. In a way, I'm one of these people who believes everything that happens in life happens for a good reason.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, Harry's death opened the door for others to jump in on it. Bruce Springsteen came in and became very big in this area, and still to this day does in the areas of hunger and homelessness.
Right,
and
yeah, right. Yeah, yeah.
Still very active. And he at Harry's memorial, he told the story of hiding from Harry in the recording studio because Harry would bug him so much about getting involved that he'd see Harry, they were recording in the same building, and when he'd see Harry coming, he'd go and hide, you know.
Right.
But he picked it up and did
it. Look what happened.
Kenny Rogers. I mean, Kenny Rogers, when Harry was killed, Kenny Rogers picked up the torch and carried it forward, contributed $1 million to the Hunger Awards for media,
wow,
which we gave at the United Nations every year.
Wow.
You know, all sorts of stuff happened as a result of Harry's tragic death. So many things we were able to pull off and do that may or may not have been possible with Harry.
Yeah.
Harry was very similar in some respects to Bob Geldof, who really started the whole recording with major stars.
Yeah,
idea.
Yeah.
Yeah, with, yeah. You know, first...
Do They Know It's Christmas?
Well, Do They Know It's Christmas, which inspired us to do
it.
And you know, Geldof would just buttonhole people. They'd run and hide from him, much like they did from Harry, because he was on a mission, much
yes,
like Harry was. And in a way, you need that. But in another way, when we got to 1984 and 85, when we recorded We Are the World, you also needed, it was a little different time, and you needed people to want to come in and want to be a part of it, and cajoling them and such wasn't quite the way we did it.
Yeah.
You know. But we talk about Geldof. Geldof was the inspiration, no question, because 2 days before Christmas, Harry Belafonte calls me and he says, you know, we got to do a concert. He said Geldof had this concert. They've raised almost $10 million now with Do They Know It's Christmas in England, but they didn't use very many African Americans or African English or whatever
mm-hmm.
they were at that point.
Right.
There were very few black acts involved, he said. We need to get, you manage, I managed Lionel Richie at that point.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I was close with Michael Jackson and Quincy Jones. He said, we got to pull all those people together. I said, well, let's not limit it just to the black artists. Let's make it everybody. And I just started from the top of the record chart. I said, we don't need to do a concert. I've tried to put a concert on for a year before with no luck for hunger. I said, let's take his example. Let's just do a bigger and better job. And so I just started, you know, Belafonte called me on 2 days before Christmas. I drove to Lionel Richie's house on the way, I called Kenny Rogers. He said, I'm in. I called a couple of my other clients, Lindsey Buckingham from Fleetwood Mac and Kim Carnes, who had number one records at that point. They said, they're in. When I got to Lionel's, I said, will you write the song? Let's call Stevie Wonder, because I thought that I always wanted Lionel and Stevie. I thought they would be a great writing combination.
Right, sure.
I can imagine.
So, but Lionel tried to get a hold of Stevie. This is the wild part. Lionel tried to get a hold of Stevie all night and couldn't get him. And talk about, I always feel blessed projects, things just happen, right?
Absolutely.
The next morning, Brenda Ritchie, Lionel's wife at the time, goes, it's the day before Christmas, she's buying last minute Christmas gifts. She goes into a jewelry store, she's shopping, and in walks Stevie Wonder. Now, whether he knew it was Brenda or not, I'm assuming somebody with him told him that it was Brenda, or whether he thought she was working there, he asked her to help him pick out jewelry for gifts.
Oh, isn't
and
that
she
amazing?
Says, not until you call my husband back. He's been trying to reach you all night. So they get on the phone. Lionel's in a dentist chair. They get Lionel out of the dentist chair, and Stevie agrees to write the song with Lionel. Now, I don't know any of this is going on. I'm, in the meantime, on the phone to Quincy, who's getting on a plane for, he's getting on the Warner Brothers plane to fly for vacation in Hawaii. I said, Quincy, I need you to produce this record, and can you get Michael to sing on it?
Mm-hmm.
He calls me back 20 minutes later. He said, Michael not only wants to sing on it, he wants to write it with Lionel. And Stevie, we thought Stevie would be involved.
Yeah.
Right.
Stevie disappears. Stevie goes off to Philadelphia for a month. We never see him until we actually get in to record the demos, and that's another story. But in the meantime, now I've... Belafonte calls me back the day after Christmas. He says,
amazing.
What do you got?
You know, he said, have you been, his question to me, and I love this, because he said, so have you been thinking about our conversation yesterday or a few
Are
days
ago? Are you kidding?
Ago?
I got it all set
I said,
up.
Well, I've got a record being produced by Quincy Jones, written by Lionel Ritchie, Stevie Wonder, and Michael Jackson. I've got Kenny Rogers, Kim Carnes, Lindsey Buckingham.
Oh, my God.
He goes, oh, okay, well, I'm
off. You work fast.
Yeah.
Christmas miracles.
You know, now, by the way, the next week, nothing happened, because the week between Christmas and New Year's
right, yeah.
You can't get anybody on the phone. But January 1st or 2nd, really 2nd probably, from that day forward, I had a basic goal, and it was, look at the record charts, work your way from the top of the record charts down, and get two artists every day. Don't go to sleep at night till you have two artists.
So you set
that type of a goal for yourself to just...
every day, two artists. By the end of the day, I would get two new artists. Now, I got turned down a few times. There were a few top artists that turned me down. In Huey Lewis's case, I wanted just Huey, because I first
you didn't want the news.
I thought I was going to get...
Well, again, vocals for the...
Yeah, you know, I wanted just 15 people.
I was going to ask that question if you had a number in mind.
Yeah, 15.
15.
I don't know why, but 15.
Okay.
Okay. Huey says, I'll do it, but not without the news. So if you look at the picture of We Are the World, mm-hmm. and you look up in the upper right-hand corner, there are three or four guys standing there who you don't know who they are. That's the news.
That's the news.
And there were other situations like that. I mean, Michael, at the last minute, wanted all his brothers and sisters. He didn't get Janet. I don't know why, but maybe she wasn't around. But he got everybody else. So there is the whole Jackson family.
Wow. So they're singing on the choruses then, I'm assuming.
Yeah, they were only on the choruses. The solos were, you know.
Right. Was there any ego involved when it came to who was going to take solos? Because obviously that's, you know, you're dealing with a lot of guys that are...
And you're all number one guys on the charts.
Yeah, so everyone's like, I need to be the first line, you need to be the first line.
Smartest thing I did was get Quincy Jones.
Okay.
Quincy Jones was so respected. And there's a story about this, and it's kind of a classic, in that we were in Kenny Rogers' recording studio. He had a recording studio here on Beverly Boulevard called Lion's Share. And he donated the studio, and we went in to cut the demos about a week before. They didn't finish, Michael and Lionel didn't finish writing the song until 2 days before we cut the demos, or even a day before. So we went in to cut the demos, and we had, and there was rhythm tracks and Michael and Lionel's guide vocals, which I found, by the way, a little tape of now. I have a tape of the original guide vocals that Michael and Lionel did. But anyway, we're in the studio and Stevie Wonder shows up, And he says, come on, let's write the song. And the guys have already written it. So they go to the piano and they show him, and he makes a couple of suggestions and he left. I always said, you know, Stevie being blind couldn't see when he said that. Everybody's mouth went, you know, I mean, everybody's like, wait a second, Stevie, we've already got it, but here it is.
Yeah.
But late that night, 3 a.m, we're sitting around on the floor in the studio, Michael, Quincy, Lionel, myself, a fellow named Tom Baylor, who was the vocal arranger on the whole thing. And Quincy basically says, I've got to write a letter that goes out with these tapes and the sheet music. He said, first thing, we're going to print on the sheet music who sings which solo. Because if we leave it up to chance that night, they'll all fight for whatever they think is the better one.
Right.
Tom Baylor had gone home with everybody's record and figured out who ought to sing what. So that was then printed on the music. I have a copy of the music framed at home, and if you look at that, there is Prince's name is on there because we thought Prince was going to show up. She Lee was his girlfriend.
Right.
She was talking to him. We all thought he was going to show up, but he didn't. But other than that, it's all basically whoever sung what. It's printed right on the
right
music.
There, right.
And then I have it signed by all the artists, which is really nice. But in any event, then Quincy said, I'm going to write this letter that goes out with these tapes and the sheet music. And I've got to tell these people, these stars, check your ego at the door. And that became the classic phrase out of We Are the World. In fact, mm-hmm. 10 years, 15 years later, when we had maybe it was even the 20th celebration, I gave Quincy a door with a plaque on it that said that. I actually had a big red door, framed door, I gave him as a gift with, you know, check your ego at the door.
That's a perfect, perfect quote, because at least that way they know. Now, did everyone record at the same time, or did they all come in different times?
No, they all came in at once.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, they came in at once.
That's the real challenge.
And it was really, well, the biggest issue wasn't the stars. We were in Studio A at A&M Studios, pretty good-sized studio. And then we took Studio B as just sort of a green room for the artists. But then each artist is bringing a wife or a friend or a manager.
Sure, so you're filling up quick.
Or so they were each allowed to bring 5 people. Where do you bring? And so I, in the meetings with my office staff and everything, I said, look, Billy Joel is married to Christie Brinkley.
Right.
All right? Our job is to figure out how do we keep Christie Brinkley happy. And she can't be in the studio because mm-hmm. we don't have room for anything. We now have 45 artists. It's grown and grown and grown.
Right.
We've got 45 artists. We barely have room for them in the studio. We can't have all the hangers-on in the studio. It'd be chaos.
Sure.
So we got, A&M Studios has a soundstage, a big soundstage right next to Studio A. So we outfitted that. We put, you know, couches and ping pong tables and
things to keep them busy.
Oh yeah, pool tables, and somebody donated all the food. Everything was donated, and then, which was quite unique for them, we put a 25-foot screen on the wall of the studio, and we took a feed from the recording Studio A, so you could see everything that was going on in the studio while you were in the guest room.
And they felt like they were in there.
So they were there.
Yeah, brilliant.
And so, you know, Christie Brinkley, along with Lionel's wife and my wife and everybody's, the people that were with everybody were all in there. There were, Jane Fonda was there. There were all kinds of celebrities there mm-hmm. as well who got to come. And so that was really kind of wild. The only problem was, and this is the issue, I had invited Geldof. So he flew over from England to be part of the record. Well, he is the most outspoken and a little bit, a lot of four-letter words.
Brassy.
And there was a little stage that we put in there in case any of the artists wanted to go in and talk to the crowd. All of a sudden, I get pulled aside by somebody. I'm in Studio A. You got to get into the soundstage. You won't believe what's happened. I run in there. Geldof is up on the platform, and he is now berating the people that are there, many of whom are the people who got us these stars in the first place, right? And Geldof is yelling at them, you're sitting here eating while people are starving in Africa. I mean, he's criticized. He doesn't know when he did the record in London, he went out and bought some Kentucky Fried Chicken or something and brought it back. Or McDonald's, you know, for everybody.
Right.
The luxury of what was going on and the size of what we're doing has no impact on him. He's just looking at all these people having fun and having a good time.
Right. Yeah.
And he's saying,
for this particular cause, and he's like, don't you understand? It's like, yeah, but this is what brought these people here.
You know, he chased maybe a third of the people away. They left.
Oh, wow.
It was really too bad. And I got in there and stopped it and tried to patch it up as best I could and everything. But it was typical of Geldof. I mean, he would do those kind of things regularly, you know.
Yeah, and he was quite known for doing that type of stuff. Yeah, and getting his
if you read his book,
there.
You know there's quite a background to it, you know. He had,
So after you recorded this and after it got launched and it became the big success that it did, what did that do for, you were raising funds?
$64 million ultimately, actually more now. We still raise, crazy thing is, to this day, we're still raising money and we're never trying. We're trying to go out of business. We've been trying for 30 years now. This year is the 30th anniversary of
And why are you trying to go out of business?
Well, simply because, you know, we don't raise enough. I mean, maybe we raise $100,000 a year and we can give 20 grants of $5,000 or something like that out. It's okay, but it requires a lot of work. It requires executive director and a lot of other stuff. And we've always, I mean, it doesn't appear we ever will go out of business. I mean, when Michael died, we did $2 million that year just on downloads.
Wow.
So and then we did some very big grants and did a lot of good work.
So these are all downloads from the song. So this is just money that's being generated from the actual song.
The song still
generated. And it's 30-year anniversary this year.
Yeah, this year. This past January 28th was the 30th anniversary. The record was released, I think, on March the 5th. Roughly around April 1 to 7 in there, there was simultaneous playing all over the world in 1985, where every radio station played the song simultaneously. Amazing thing.
Yeah.
You know, there was, and then everything led to, then of course, Live Aid.
I was going to say, and that 30th anniversary is like right around now.
When Geldof was at Record We Are the World that night, and then in the subsequent days, he pushed me about producing the U.S. version of Live Aid.
Of course he did.
You know, at that point, I mean, who knew? I don't even know if it was called Live Aid. He won the big concert.
Yeah.
Remember, I had decided to do a record because I'd been frustrated the year before in
trying
doing a concert.
Trying to do a concert,
So my idea was, Bob, you're never going to get there. I mean, I hate to say this now because it was such a success, but my idea was, great idea, Bob. That's not going to happen. But more importantly... I was so swept up in what I had. Remember, I still was running a management business with a lot of big clients. I had the biggest management company, perhaps.
You already were working full time as it was.
And my clients weren't too happy about how much time I was spending on We Are the World as opposed to, you know. So, in any event, I said, Bob, I can't do it, but I recommended Bill Graham. And I helped him get Bill. But then Bill was calling me every few days because Bill didn't have a great relationship with a lot of the African-American artists. And Michael wouldn't work for him. Stevie wouldn't work for him. Prince wouldn't work for him. So he couldn't get these key artists to agree to go to Live Aid. So he would call me because he had to have Lionel. And I eventually got him Lionel. It wasn't easy. But I also got him Harry Belafonte, who flew in by helicopter and so on for Live Aid. But then, you know, after that, there was Farm Aid.
Right.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, and we went into a period. On the way out to Live Aid, one of the most appropriate things was said, and it was the most amazing thing to me. Jeff Bridges. I was driving out to Live Aid, to the actual concert that day, with Jeff Bridges. And he said, and I'll never forget this, he said, you know, he said, I feel like the seeds that were planted by people like Bob Dylan and Joan Baez in the 60s and lay fallow in the me generation of the 70s and the cold earth have now in the 80s broken through the ground and finally blossomed and bore fruit.
Wow.
It was the most perfect quote of what had happened. And
pretty true.
Yeah, it really was.
Very true, yeah.
And, you know, Dylan was part of We Are the World. Baez wasn't, and I really wanted her to be, but... The problem was our whole emphasis up until the very last few days, when we added some people just to get the right kind of sound.
Yeah.
Our whole emphasis was on sales. Let's get the biggest selling artist. Baez was nowhere near the charts in those days.
Right.
Neither was John Denver, who'd been a friend of mine. I'd represented him. You know, so there were people that were left off simply by the fact that they weren't the hot artists at that point in time. And then at the last minute, Quincy decided he needed a few key singers. So he added James Ingram, he added Dionne Warwick, you know, he added two or three other, you know, tremendous vocalists.
Yeah. I was going to say, did anything get switched, like we were going to have so-and-so sing this line, and then we heard it, and it didn't work out as well, so we had to switch it? Because, I mean, that's a big risk to just sort of say, we've got 15 people that are going to sing lead, and we think it's all going to flow the right way, but then it's like, that didn't really work as well, can we switch that line? I would have thought they would sing the whole thing.
I don't recall that, but I do recall this. Quincy went in later, after the session, in the 2 weeks following, and brought Ray Charles in, he brought Stevie Wonder in, he brought to do, and he may have even brought Springsteen in, to do specific emphasis and extra lines and extra work, and he added a lot post the major recording session, so that when you watch it and you hear a lot of it, particularly some of Springsteen's stuff and Ray Charles's stuff, well, and Stevie, it's all very strong stuff. The one interesting thing during the recording session, which interests you as a musician, Bob Dylan, the solos were being done with everybody in the room, and they were coming. People were coming up to the microphone, and all gathered around the microphone to sing the solo. We did the choruses first. Some of the stars left, and the ones who were going to record solo stayed. When they got to Dylan, he got up in the microphone, and he didn't exactly freeze, but he didn't sound like Bob Dylan at all. So Lionel and Quincy cleared the studio. We all went in the control room. And now, they sat down at the piano, one at a time, Stevie Wonder, Quincy, and Lionel, and they did Bob Dylan. They mimicked what Bob Dylan sounds like.
Wow.
And they said, Bob, here's what it is, here's what you do. And Bob then went to the microphone and delivered a perfect Bob Dylan. But they did him. They went on. Stevie could do them perfectly.
Really?
You know, he has a certain voice, you know, and a certain texture to it. So
he was so nervous doing it in front of his peers. You know,
sure,
he's a very shy guy. You know, so.
Well, a guy like that, especially because he doesn't have the strongest voice. I mean, he's known for his lyrics. He's not known as a vocalist.
Well, and then he's got a room full of these superstars sitting there, you know, that he considers his peers. I mean,
they were, you know,
a lot of good stuff came out of Billy Joel and Ray Charles end up doing an album together.
Oh, really?
Right.
Yeah.
What a great album, actually.
A lot of cool stuff.
And that was as a result of that collaboration.
Yeah.
Wow,
I think they
very
came out in I have that record.
Now, the interesting thing, you know, you talk about in between all the We Are the World stuff and Live Aid, which happened in July, in between, in fact, Live Aid, right around now, I mean, it was pretty much just, you know, I went to Africa with the first supplies. 26 of us went. Belafonte went. Some of the stars went with us. Not very many. Dionne Warwick wanted to go, but at the time she was chain smoking, and we were 46 hours in an airplane.
That isn't going to happen.
We told her, "You're not going."
That's not going to happen
at that point. So anyway, I come back from there. I get off the plane. I'm being picked up by a volunteer at the airport, and I can remember the exact moment as we were starting to get on that walkway. Powered walkway, he says to me, "You know, it's wonderful what you're doing for Africa. We've got a lot of problems here in the U.S. What are you going to do for the United States? What are you going to do for the hungry and the homeless here?" Because what had happened was the media that had never been covering that stuff. That was what Harry Chapin was fighting against all the
time. Yeah.
The media started covering what was going on in America and discovered that there were whole parts of America, well, almost everywhere, where there were people, the kids going to bed hungry at night, people starving, people living
on
homeless
on the streets.
Yeah. And that had never been covered. So suddenly it was out there in the media, and he said, "What are you going to do for America?" And somebody had suggested to me a month before, just before I left for Africa, this idea of Hands Across America. You know, what if we, and it was a publicist for We Are the World, he was thinking of a way to promote We Are the World. We'll all reach out, hold hands, and everybody will sing We Are the World. So that was his thinking, because he was working on promoting We Are the World. The minute this fellow said it to me, that idea popped back up in my head, and I went, wait a second, we've got to do Hands Across America.
Yeah.
So I immediately went to AT&T, because AT&T's theme was Reach Out and Touch.
That's
right.
Yeah.
Perfect, right?
Perfect sponsor.
They spent 2 months considering it.
Two months considering it, like as if it wouldn't be that quick.
Well, what happened was, during that 2 months, the U.S. government made them divest of certain companies because they gave them a bad time about being, you know, a monopoly or whatever.
Okay.
They fired 5,000 employees. They didn't feel that they could put the money up for Hands Across America, millions of dollars, when they had just fired.
They were in trouble a little bit here. Yeah.
So they, after around or beginning of August, they said, sorry, we can't do it. I thought the project wasn't going to happen. And about a month later, mid-September really, I got a call from a guy named Sergio Zeman, who was the marketing director for Coca-Cola. And Lionel Richie and Michael Jackson had both, the year before, signed deals with Pepsi-Cola.
Right.
Coke had tried to get it. In fact, in Lionel's case, I was in Atlanta negotiating with Coke, and my cohort, the guy that was helping me with sponsorships, was in Purchase, New York, dealing with the head of Pepsi. And I was meeting with committees at Coke, and he was dealing with Roger Enrico at Pepsi. So when Sergio called me and said, why did we lose these guys to Pepsi? Tell me, what did we do wrong? It was the perfect setup. I said, what you did wrong was you go into committee and you can't make a decision, and one guy stands up and objects, and then there's months of debating. In the meantime, the president of Pepsi says, sure, let's do it.
Right.
You know, he didn't have to go ask anybody.
He didn't have to think about it.
So he said, what do you have now?
He goes, I'm glad you asked.
Yeah. I said, well, I've been playing around with this idea called Hands Across America. He says, when is it? Next May. Oh, that's our 100th anniversary. We've got a couple of things we're doing. We need one more thing. This is perfect. How much? I said, Sergio, it's $3 to $5 million. He said, we got it. We take it. Good. Done conversation. 3 minutes.
Okay? Wow.
Hangs up. A week later, he calls me. He says, where do I send the $3 million check? I said, Sergio, it's five. He said, you said three. I said, no, I said three to five, and it's five. Next day, I had a $5 million check from Coke.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I meant 15. Did I say five?
Didn't I say seven?
Did I stop? Yeah, exactly.
We're going to take a quick commercial break for our sponsors, and we will be right back with Mr. Tony St. Tone and the fabulous Mr. Ken Craigie.
USALuxuryDirect.com. 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 Top name brands from around the world, sold at discounted prices. Hundreds of items to choose from. Put Humanitarian Radio in the coupon zone for a 10% discount at USALuxuryDirect.com.
So we are back, and we are delighted to be talking today with Mr. Ken Craigan and Tony St. Tone, and we are looking to pick his brain a little bit on what fabulous things he's been able to do in the world. We've been talking about a lot of events that he's put on or been a strong part of, contributor to, over the years. And now what I want to know from you, Ken, is what do you think, on a whole, that you've been able to contribute to humanity as a result of putting on these great events that you've gotten people together, to work together, to help other people, and you've done some phenomenal work.
Well, in hard dollars, we've probably raised $106,000 or something from over the years from We Are the World and Hands Across America, I'm not counting Live Aid in there. I think Live Aid's in the $200,000 amount that they've raised over the years. But it isn't ever the money. It's more the awareness.
Right.
What a lot of people aren't old enough to remember or don't remember because it's so long ago is that, you know, 30, 35 years ago, the media didn't cover these kinds of issues. It wasn't exactly a conspiracy, but editors really felt, Harry Chapin brought this home to me, editors really felt that the public didn't want to see this. It didn't sell papers, it didn't get people. You know, who wants to see starving children on television? And you couldn't see them unless you were at 1 o'clock at night, Christian Children's Network, or whatever.
Sally Struthers.
That's where you saw it.
And
so, biggest thing we did is bring these issues out in the forefront. I must say, to the extent that in that period of time, particularly the 80s, a lot was done about them. Over the years, it became so much part of the story. If you open a paper any day now, you can see stuff.
Right.
On the internet and everywhere. that it also people became kind of, you know, used to it. They started taking it for granted.
Yeah.
It's the reason that it's harder to mount those kinds of things now.
Totally agree.
Because it's not a new issue. It's been around. Everybody's aware of it. Nobody particularly feels that it has a...
And everybody thinks someone else is going to take care of the problem.
They do. And so I always encourage working on a local level. But the biggest thing we did was raise awareness. And that's been true constantly in everything I've done. I mean, I've been involved in so many, even now, I'm involved in so many humanitarian projects, and raising awareness is always a major part of it. The dollars are important. You can do good work with the dollars. But the awareness becomes one of the really key things.
And the awareness ends up generating way more dollars than the actual original event did.
Yeah.
And it's the trickle-down effect, and it goes on for generations.
Well, and the awareness gets people involved, where you can get people to give their time.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is, once you say, go build on a Habitat for Humanity house, okay, the feeling of doing that is so good that you want to get it again and you want to go back. So whereas you might have been willing to spend a half a day doing that or a couple of hours or whatever, all of a sudden you want it to be a regular part of your life. I have friends who go every week and serve food at, you know, at the kitchen, you know, for the poor and the hungry. It's, you know, it's just a regular thing that you try to get people involved. I've always tried that. And the other thing simply is that people have to realize how much difference an individual can make. Not necessarily on the huge, massive scale that some of the stuff I've done. Remember, I've had the access to certain talent and dollars and other things that not everybody does. Where you can really make a difference is on the smaller level, even on the individual level. You know, start by making a difference in a few people's lives.
Right.
You know, just get out there and try it. The amazing thing is what you'll get back.
Absolutely.
You get back so much more for what you give. It's truly there. It comes back to you. But you have to do it. By the way, you have to do it not seeking the payback.
Exactly. I'm so happy to hear you say that, because this is a philosophy that Tony and I live by.
Yeah.
We're very much about doing things for someone else, expecting nothing in return. And absolutely what you get in your heart and in your soul and in your whole body overwhelmingly is nothing but joy as a result. We've done this.
And it comes back.
Yeah, absolutely.
Time and time it comes back.
Absolutely.
When you're not looking for it, it comes back.
Absolutely.
And you just do it, you know. And
we started our radio show, Humanitarian Radio, for this exact reason. Because we've been doing charity stuff for 20 plus years. And it's provided so much satisfaction for us. Whether we're going room to room at All Children's Hospital or performing in the jails in L.A. County or we're doing whatever. It gives you so much. But then when you have a platform to talk about how that is making you feel, you're inspiring other people to get into the game.
Yeah.
Do what we're doing. Have fun, but make changes in other people's lives while you're really getting a great amount of love back at you.
Yeah, I've had this plan. I tried to do it when Obama was elected. I tried to get them to do it, and they were too busy trying just to get transitioned in there.
Yeah.
But I wanted them to. I wanted him to ask, actually, every American to give him 2 hours a month of volunteer time.
Oh, wow.
And I
that
felt
that
if we could get 20 million people to give us 2 hours,
wow,
be 40
imagine.
Million hours a month, okay, those 2 hours would turn into many more hours, because people, most
absolutely.
Of those people would want to do more. But
wow.
You would create a volunteer force. And there are organizations out there, Points of Light in Atlanta, which the Bushes started, but which Clinton and Obama and everybody supports, they can direct you exactly to whatever kind of cause you want to get involved in.
Yeah.
There, you know, whatever charity you want to work on or whatever thing you believe in or you care about, it's there for you to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There are other lessons, though. You know, from We Are the World and Hands Across America and Live Aid and NetAid, which I did in the late 90s, and so on. And even some of the stuff I'm doing now, I'm working with NASA and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory now on a big humanitarian project. The couple of principles, you know, one is, you know, think big.
Yeah.
Take what you're doing and then think about how can I make this unique and different. The philosophy I have is it's easier to accomplish the impossible than the ordinary.
I love that.
And the reason is real simple. If I'm doing the ordinary, everybody looks at it and goes, oh, okay, well, I've seen that. I know that. They don't pay attention.
Yeah.
You don't break through in today's sea of noise. You just don't. Mm-hmm. If I'm doing something that everybody goes, oh, my God, there's no way in the world he's going to accomplish that. How do they, that's crazy. How is he going to do that? No way. Not going to happen. All of a sudden, you've gotten to the first base because you've got their attention.
Yes.
And absolutely.
And you know, getting people's attention is the way you ultimately accomplish stuff. You can't get them to take action unless you get their attention. So I've found that, you know, taking each thing that I try to do and thinking, what's totally unique about this? What can I do to make this so big it gets attention, or so special that it's something unique about it? What is it that's going to grab people? That's really important.
What's the awe factor?
Yeah, the wow factor, yeah. As I say. Really. Yeah, the awe factor or the wow factor. Another thing, and this is a quote from Thornton Wilder, from the writer Thornton Wilder. He said, every great thing balances at all times on the razor edge of disaster. And very interesting that the better the event, the more important, the bigger the thing that I was doing, the more a cause was, the more it was at all moments on the razor edge of disaster. I mean, you know, the rock artist tried to back out of We Are the World the night before.
And
he didn't, because Bruce Springsteen said, I'm going to be there, and they would have looked foolish if they weren't there. But they didn't like the song, and they didn't want to stand next to the non-rockers. They thought it would diminish them. So,
that's
ego again. That ego cropping in.
You know, the Hands Across America didn't have insurance a month before, and my board said, no insurance, you aren't doing the event. You know, stuff, every time you have, and what you have to do in that case, if you believe, if you have that passion we talked about earlier, if you believe that this is it and the importance of it, you fight your way through it. There is a solution. You fight your way through. You don't throw in the towel. You've always got that moment when you could throw in the towel. But I've learned, you know, if you don't go through and create the product, the event, the activity, whatever, you have nothing. So somehow I get through the obstacles to keep, because then I at least have something. And ultimately, that usually pays off.
And even if that something ends up to fail in one result or another, you still have gotten the attention of people, and you've still made the awareness. So you're a success either way.
Exactly. You know, it's funny, with Hands Across America, we set out with the idea we raised $50 to $100 million. We'd already raised $64 million from We Are the World. We only raised $34 million. And some in the media called that a failure because we had set this $50 million goal. The reality was that not only did we expose this tremendously, the Reagan administration was holding up $800 million in funds to feed women, children, and infants, and they were forced as a result of Hands Across America to release it. So we didn't raise $834 million. We raised $834 million.
Unbelievable.
Wow.
So you never, you know, you have to, these things always have that opportunity. And so that's a really, really critical point. The other thing that I try to teach people, and you'll love this, Tony, is music's involved in every project I do. I'm doing a space project right now with a huge number of superstars.
Yeah, tell musicians. Us about that a little bit. Can you say anything?
You know, I can't talk too much about it yet.
We can talk
about it later in the year or maybe next year.
When it comes out, maybe we can have you come back and
it'll
talk
be coming
about
out
that.
About a year from now. So,
but something very
amazing.
Unique.
But it has to do with music
and space.
And space. And that's all we can give you.
And that should be enough of a teaser to have you watching this guy.
Are there anything else, other projects that you're involved in right now that you can't?
I'm a consultant for the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. Type 1 diabetes is a terrible disease, which about 3 million people have. Type 1 and 2 is the most common disease in America. Mm-hmm. Type 2 affects about 24 to 25 million people. So diabetes overall is somewhere between 27 and 29 million.
Wow.
It's the number one thing in America. And
I had no idea.
Yeah, and I just read an article in the LA Times the other day saying that dementia is 85% higher in people with diabetes. Which is really interesting. So controlling diabetes
is pretty critical. Your future.
So I help on the celebrity side, on the fundraising side, on the relationship and connection side, I do that. I have about 8 projects going now. I've got 3 television projects. I've got I'm always, you know, in the midst of a something. Waiting for a script on a new movie to do. And
are you still managing people?
No, I don't really manage anymore. Mm-hmm. I'll advise people at times, but I got out of that. I got out to about 2008. Interestingly, what I found is I didn't have a superstar artist anymore. I could get anybody on the phone, but getting people to agree, getting a television show to take a relatively new act or whatever, unless they had something, you had something they needed.
Right.
Right.
They might be nice to you, but they weren't going to deliver for it.
Right.
If you had leverage, you know, if you could say, hey, if you want Pharrell Williams, you got to take
this package deal.
Yeah, I mean, you wouldn't quite do it that way because that wouldn't be fair to the superstar. But you would be in that position where they wanted your goodwill. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that really happened in the industry is things became so corporate. Where I could pick up the phone and call Gelman, who was producing Regis and Kathy, mm-hmm. for years, and just say, I've got this artist, and say, send him to New York, we'll put him on.
Right.
All of a sudden they were saying, do they have a top five record? Everything changed. Everything became about ratings. Everything became corporate. Everything became much more demanding. You just didn't have the opportunity to make it happen. So Kenny Rogers and I parted after 33 years in 2001, and I didn't have another superstar artist at that point. And from 2001 to 2008, I handled some tremendously talented people, and we just didn't break through for one reason or another. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it just became obvious to me that, you know, I was getting older. I didn't want to wait around for somebody to break 5 years later.
Right.
And it was time to do something. And I flipped careers. I essentially made what had been the pro bono part of my life, consulting for nonprofits and mm-hmm. doing all that work. I made that into my career.
And it was something you loved, as you've been doing it your whole life anyway.
You do well by doing good.
Sure, exactly. Sure.
Can't do better than that.
You have to love that.
Tony Robbins and I are working on a book by that title. I don't know if we'll ever get it done. But it'd be perfect for you guys. It's a look at volunteerism in America.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. And why do we not know if it's ever going to get done?
Well, it's just, you know, it evolved from a book to a television show. And now the feeling is the TV show will drive the book, but we haven't sold the show. So we'll see what happens.
Okay.
And Tony, in the meantime, has his own number one bestseller right now.
Yeah, he's got a lot going on.
Great guns. But he was nice enough to say, hey, I'm in. So we'll see when it happens.
Excellent.
Well, it's a great idea either way, if it does or doesn't. I mean, again, the seed has been planted, so now it's just waiting for it to grow. And maybe someone else will take the torch. I really want to thank you for taking the time, because you are an extremely busy person, taking the time to be with us. It's been an absolute pleasure.
As you know, and the way I'm dressed, I'm on my way to a workout, because that's got to be part of your week as well.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Thank you for taking the time to be with us.
Let me just say, you've inspired me to go try some Pilates.
You should do it.
I'm in. I've been thinking about it, but I think I'm over the edge now, and it's worth giving it a shot.
Stick
so I appreciate that. Yeah. So we want to thank you guys for watching our show. We, again, are here with Mr. Ken Cragen. And we thank you, and keep your eye on what he's doing, and check out what is happening coming up with his Tony Robbins project and also with NASA. Very mm-hmm. exciting.
Yeah.
So that concludes our interview with Ken Cragen, but watch for the video that we shot with him, where you're going to see some behind the scenes of We Are the World, Hands Across America, and some really cool things. It's coming up soon. It'll be on our website, and we'll be sure to post it on our Facebook. If you know of a story, or if you know someone that should be on our show, by all means, connect with us on Facebook at Humanitarian Radio, or go to our website, humanitarianradio.com, and reach out to us. Let us know any good news that you have out there that you want to share with the world.
Make it a good week.
We'll see you next time. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Humanitarian Radio, shouting out some good news for your soul.